ags to white, had burned in and eaten the beauty out of her hands.
"Don't stare at me like that," cried Masha. "I know how I look. Tell me better about yourself. How do you come here so early?"
I told her how I suffered through the night at Bessie's and that I left home.
"Where will you live? What will you do? With Mo for my bread giver, I'm too dirt poor to help you."
"You think I've come to hang myself upon your neck? I can get a job quicker and lightning. If I stay with you, I'll pay for my eating." Masha's face brightened.
"Maybe your coming will give me the chance to tear myself out of the house some Sunday. Since the babies came, I'm like in a prison. And yet, come see how lucky I am. They are so good."
We went into the other room. Danny and Ruthie were playing on the floor, happily tearing up an old newspaper. Masha sat down to feed the baby. Danny and Ruthie cuddled against her knees, playing with the baby's feet. Gone were the worry and fear from Masha's eyes. It breathed from her, the pride and the joy that these three were born of her, fed by her, living and breathing because of her being. Sunshine flowed out of her eyes over her children.
"When I have them like this, I feel I'm holding the riches of heaven in my arms."
The room darkened. The gas jet began to flicker and go out.
"Oh, my God!"
Frightened worry came back into Masha's face.
"The gas is going out. It's a quarter meter. What shall I do? Where shall I borrow now?"
Masha thrust the children on the floor.
"Such a miserable existence. I wish they were never born. Can I never run away from this money? Money, money!"
The children got so scared, they all began to cry. "Why do you leave out your misery on their innocent heads?" I scolded Masha.
"It's their innocence that chains me to this misery. I'm insulted by the milkman, shamed by the grocer, kicked like a dog by their father, all on account of them."
While Masha tore at her hair, cursing the bitter luck of her poverty, I took a quarter out of my counted pennies, climbed on a chair, and put it into the meter. The room grew light again. The children stopped their crying. But Masha no longer had patience to look at them. She turned to the tub full of soaking clothes.
"I've got to get all this out on a line, the dinner cooked and the children in bed before Mo comes."
Savagely, she clapped a shirt on the washboard. Her back humped like an angry cat's as she flung into the tub. Again, the grind of poverty hardened her face. Again, the crazy, wasting hurry to beat the race of hours, forcing her two thin hands to do the work of a steam laundry. Toward evening, I put the children to bed while Masha rushed to get the dinner ready. And then for half an hour, the eating stood on the table, and Mo didn't come. At last, Masha got tired of watching the clock, and we sat down to eat. We had no sooner finished washing up the dishes when the bread giver came in, smiling, carefree, blowing his chest with pride and pleasure in himself. The sight of his piggish face and new-bought clothes got me so mad that I fled to the next room.
"How you look!"
Mo's voice was full of disgust.
"The janitress is more decent dressed."
"Why didn't you come home for dinner?"
asked Masha with the patience of long-suffering.
"I waited for you again."
"I have to have peace to think out my business worries."
"But it cost you so much to eat out."
"What do you think? I depend on what you cook for me? For my dollar, I can go to the finest restaurant, and I'm served like a king."
"I'm going crazy from the bills, while you..."
"Who tells you to make bills? If you have no money, then don't buy anything."
He drew a cigarette from his silk vest, lit it, and then, through the smoke, he eyed her coldly.
"You're nothing but a worn-out rag."
"How can I take time to look decent, with all the work and worry on my head?"
"If it would be in you, you'd find time. With your worn-out face, nice clothes would be wasted on you."
Masha sank into a chair, her drawn lips whitened with pain. Mo glanced at her swollen ankles.
"Always there's something the matter with you. I hate sick people. You're just like a horse. You work, work till you can't move. You don't know when to stop till you drop. If I'd ever go out with you now, people would only wonder how such a nice man come to have such a worn-out rag for a wife.
I had been trying to control myself, but now I could hold in no longer. I rushed into the kitchen.
If you were my husband, I'd kill you. I'd scrub floors sooner than live with a thing like you.
You would, eh? His eyes reddened with rage as he glared at me. I'm not your husband, and the way I run my house is none of your damn business.
It is my business. Masha is my sister. How dare you eat yourself in a restaurant while the children's milk bill is unpaid? You married Masha because she was beautiful. Then you piled your children on her neck, starved her, wore her out. You spoiled her beauty. Then you blame her for losing it.
Get the hell out of here. If I put my hands on you, I'll break your neck. The idea of a little skinny runt telling me how to run my home.
Even in my fury, I saw the hopelessness of trying to take Masha's part when she hadn't the grit to stand up for herself. I stepped into the next room, seized my hat and coat, and walked out. Book 2. Between Two Worlds. Chapter 10. I shut the door. Turning me out in the street like dirt, the heartlessness. Mo Mirsky. He'll yet suffer for my suffering. I'll yet show him, and show Zalman, and show them all who I am. Ugh, only to make myself somebody great, and have them come begging favors at my feet. And then it flashed to me, the story from the Sunday paper. A girl, slaving away in the shop. Her hair was already turning gray, and nothing had ever happened to her. Then suddenly she began to study in the night school, then college, and worked and studied on and on till she became a teacher in the schools. A school teacher? I saw myself sitting back like a lady at my desk, the children, their eyes on me, watching and waiting for me to call out the different ones to the board, to spell a word or answer me a question. It was like looking up to the top of the highest skyscraper while down in the gutter. All night long I walked the streets, drunk with my dreams. I didn't know how the hours flew, how or where my feet carried me, until I saw the man turning out the lights of the street lamps. Was it already morning? The silence woke up from the block. There began the rumbling of milk wagons, the clatter of bottles and cans, and the hum of opening stores, peddlers filling their pushcarts with fruit and loaves of bread. I wasn't a bit tired, but I was starving hungry, and I walked into the nearest bakery for a cup of coffee with 2 rolls, for 10 cents. As I sat there, in the stillness of the morning, I realized that I had yet never been alone since I was born. This was the first time I ate by myself, with silence and stillness for my company. At home, when they sat down to eat, all my sisters were talking everything at once. I remember one night coming home from the shop, my bones cracking from tiredness. I crawled into the bedroom and tried to close the door.
"What is the matter? Are you sick?" they asked.
"No. I only want a little quiet in me. I only want to be alone."
"Look only, the princess!" My sisters dragged me back to the noisy kitchen. "Crazy! Ain't we good enough for you anymore?"
Even after my sisters were married, mealtime was when Mother let out her bitter heart of worry and Father hammered out his preaching like a wound-up phonograph. In the shop, the girls were talking all at once, clothes, styles, bows, and dances, each one trying to out-yell the other. Perhaps in this same bakery it would be full of noise in an hour or two, but now, thank God, it was still, and I was alone in that stillness. How strong, how full of life and hope I felt as I walked out of that bakery. I opened my arms, burning to hug the new day. The strength of 1,000,000 people was surging up in me.
I felt I could turn the earth upside down with my littlest finger. I wanted to dance, to fly in the air and kiss the sun and stars with my singing heart.
I, alone with myself, was enjoying myself for the first time as with grandest company.
In this high-hearted mood, I began to look for a room where I could be alone. All the room-to-let signs that I passed seemed like so many doors opening to a new life.
The first house I tried, the toilette room, was on the top floor. I flew up the 5 flights of stairs on wings.
"You have a room?"
I asked, my eyes laughing and my voice singing the joy in me. A hard, mean look hit me in the face.
"I don't take girls."
And the woman slammed the door. In the next house, I walked up a little slower, and my voice had a quietness not like my own. A washed-out, thin-lipped woman with little, suspicious eyes examined me.
"No girls," snapped this one, too.
"Why no girls?"
I dared ask the skinny Tsarina.
"I want to keep my house clean. No cooking, no washing. Less trouble, less dirt with men."
My heart sank to my feet, but I forced myself to hunt on. I had to find a place to live. In the rear basement, a fat yenta in a loose wrapper showed me a little coffin of a room, dark as the grave.
"I've got 3 girls sleeping here already, and there's yet a place for a fourth in the bed. I charge only $3 a month.
I want a room all alone to myself."
"You? A room alone?"
She gave me one fierce look till my cheeks began to burn.
"This is a decent house. I'm a respectable woman."
On and on I searched. Each place took it out of me more and more. For the first time in my life, I saw what a luxury it was for a poor girl to want to be alone in a room. My knees bent under me. I was ready to drop from weariness when I saw a crooked sign in a scrawling hand. "Private room, a bargain cheap." It was a dark hole on the ground floor, opening into a narrow shaft. The only window where some light might have come in was thick with black dust. The bed seesawed on its broken feet, one shorter than the others. The mattress was full of lumps, and the sheets were shreds and patches. But the room had a separate entrance to the hall, a door I could shut, and it was only $6 a month.
"This is just the thing for me," I cried. "I'll clean it up like a little palace."
Through half-shut eyes, the woman examined me.
"Can you pay on time?"
she asked.
"Of course I can pay."
I drew myself up, tall as the ceiling.
"By what you work?"
"I'm not asking for any charity that I should have to tell you my business."
"But I got to know if you're working steady to pay me my rent."
"You won't have to worry. I'm working by day and studying for a teacher by night."
She drew back as if I was about to rob her.
"My gas! My gas bill! What I'd get from your rent, I'd lose on the gas." "I already had an experience with one like you. She took out books from the library, and in the middle of the night I could see by the crack in the door that she was burning away my gas, reading."
I looked at the room. A separate door to myself. A door to shut out all the noises of the world. And only $6.
Where could I get such a bargain in the whole East Side?
Like a drowning person clinging to a rope, my tired body edged up to that door and clung to it. My hands clutched at the knob. This door was life. It was air. The bottom starting point of becoming a person. I simply must have this room with the shut door, and I must make this woman rent it to me. If I failed to get it, I'd drop dead at her feet.
"Look only on me," I commanded her. "You're a smart woman. You ought to know yourself on a person, first sight. Here, I give you a month's rent in advance."
And I pushed the $6 into her hand. Her whole face lighted up with friendliness. She counted the money, then kissing each dollar for good luck, she handed me the key. At last, alone in my room, I let go of everything, the weight of my body falling against the closed door. The aloneness was enough for me, and in a moment it sank me to sleep. The first thing when I opened my eyes, I counted out the money I had left in my little knot, only $3.65 between me and hunger, a job, and I must get it at once. It was slack season in the factories. I walked the streets, wondering where to turn for work, when I passed a laundry. A big printed sign was in the window, "Ironer Wanted." As I opened the door, a blinding wave of heat struck my face. The air was full of the sweaty smell of washing clothes. At the back, girls could scarcely be seen through the clouds of steam. Hair was sticking to their faces, necks streamed with sweat. A huge, bulgy-faced man sat on the counter, marking colors.
"Do you need an ironer?"
I asked. He looked at me from his big height till I felt like a speck of dust under his feet. With a grunt, he went on marking the laundry. I put my courage into my teeth and faced him.
"You got a sign out, ironer wanted."
"Yes, but not you," he growled. "I want someone who can swing an iron."
And he pointed with his thumb to a husky German woman with giant red arms who ironed a white dress with big, steady strokes.
"That's the kind I need for an ironer."
"But let me only show you how good I can iron," I begged. "I was quicker than the big ones in my shop."
He tried me with an iron and an empty board with a small lot. But though I put all my strength into it, I was so nervous with him watching me, I thought the job was lost. But the man nodded kindly as I handed him the ironed apron.
"You got guts, all right," he chuckled. "I'll start you at the mangle for 5 a week, and later I'll break you into an ironer."
By the evening, I was so tired that I walked into the Grand Street cafeteria for something to eat. I had read about the place in the paper. Kind, rich ladies had opened it for working girls to have their meals in beautiful surroundings and cheap. It was good to see flowers on the table, and the clean, educated face of the lady manager who sat by the desk. I needed something beautiful to look at after that hard day in the laundry. The portions were a little skimpy, but the white curtains and the clean, restful place lifted me with longing for the higher life. Great dreams spurred my feet on my way to night school.
"What do you want to learn?" asked the teacher at the desk.
"I want to learn everything in the school from the beginning to the end."
She raised the lids of her cold eyes and stared at me.
"Perhaps you had better take one thing at a time," she said indifferently. "There's a commercial course, manual training."
"I want a quick education for a teacher," I cried.
A hard laugh was my answer. Then she showed me the lists of the different classes, and I came out of my high dreams by registering for English and arithmetic. Then I began 5 nights a week in a crowded class of 50, with a teacher so busy with her class that she had no time to notice me. The first morning in my room, I awoke very early. My head was clear, and I looked with full eyes on the thick dirt that I had grabbed in such anxious haste. There were only a few rusty nails on the door for my clothes. The table was shaky, and the one chair was patched with boards. Against this heart-choking dinginess flashed Masha's shining little palace. Her place was once worse than this, and she polished it up. Why can't I? A pot of paint, a little white oilcloth with brass tacks, a scrubbing brush with soap. But first of all, I thought, if only I could wash away the mud of ages from that window, it would make it lighter in the room. When my landlady saw me start on my cleaning, she cried warningly,
"I never washed the window since I lived here, not even for the holidays, because the upstairs tenants, a black year on them, are always throwing down things. Their hands should only fall to their sides."
But I wouldn't listen to her, and began to wash the window. The minute I stuck my head out, a bunch of potato peelings fell on me. I shook off the peelings and went on with the washing. Someone began shaking a carpet. Then a shower of ashes blinded me. I sank on the bed, all the strength out of my arms and fingers.
The deadening dirt! How could I ever do anything in this airless gloom?
If I open the window, the dirt will be flying in. If I keep it closed, how can I breathe? I don't ask for fancy furniture, but only a little light for the eyes, only a clean window such as Masha has in her blackest poverty. The sound of the factory whistle brought me to my feet. Already 7 o'clock? My fussing over the window made it too late for me to start cooking my coffee for breakfast. I grabbed a slice of black bread and ate as I hurried to the car. Fool that I am, trying to imitate Masha, her cleanliness. 10 hours I must work in the laundry, 2 hours in the night school, 2 hours more to study my lessons. When can I take time to be clean? If I'm to have strength and courage to go on with what I set out to do, I must shut my eyes to the dirt. That evening, after night school, I spread my books out on my table and began to hammer into my thick head the difference between a noun, a verb, and a preposition. Oh, the noise around me. But I tried to struggle on with the lesson. A noun is the name of anything. A verb is the predicate of action. A preposition connects words. The more I repeated the definitions, the more mixed up I got. It was all words, words, about words. Maybe it was the terrible racket that was muddling my brain. Phonographs and pianolas blared against each other, voices gossiping and jabbering across the windows, wailing children, the yowling shrieks of two alley cats, the shrill bark of a hungry pup. The jarring clatter tore me by the hair, stretched me out of my skin, and grated under my teeth. I felt like one crucified in a torture pit of noise. Then I clasped my hands over my head and began talking to myself. Stop all this sensitiveness, or you're beaten already before the fight is begun. You've got to study. As you had to shut your eyes to the dirt, so you must shut your ears to the noise. A quietness within me soothed my tortured nerves. I turned to my books on the table, and with fierce determination to sink myself into my head, I began my lessons again. Chapter 11. A Piece of Meat. By the whole force of my will, I could reason myself out of the dirt and noise around me. But how could I reason with my hungry stomach? How could I stretch my $5 a week to meet all my needs? I took a piece of paper and wrote it all down. $1.50 for rent, 60 cents for carfare. I couldn't walk that long distance to work and back and have time for night school. No saving there. And I must put aside at least 50 cents a week to pay back mother's rent money. What is there left for food? $2.40. That means 34 2/7 cents a day. How could I have enough to eat from that? But that's all I can have now. Somehow it's got to do. But whenever I passed a restaurant or a delicatessen store, I couldn't tear my eyes away from the food in the window. Something wild in me wanted to break through the glass, snatch some of that sausage and corned beef, and gorge myself just once. One day in the laundry, while busy ironing a shirt, the thought of mother's cooking came over me. Why was it that mother's simplest dishes, her plain potato soup, her gefüllte fish, were so filling? And what was the matter with the cafeteria food that had left me hungrier after eating it than before? For a moment I imagined myself eating mother's gefüllte fish. A happy memory floated over me. A feast I was having. What a melting taste in the mouth.
Hey! There!
Cried the boss, rushing madly at me.
Oy vey! Smoke was rising from under my iron! Oh, I'll wash it out!
I gasped in fright as I lifted the iron and saw the scorched triangle.
But the boss snatched the shirt away from me. $3 out of your wages for this, he raged.
Not a word could I say. Either it was to lose my job or pay, and I could not lose my job. $3 out from my wages, when every fraction of a penny was counted out where it had to go. Maybe for weeks I'd have to live on dry bread to make up the loss. I got so frightened. From weakness I longed to throw myself in some dark corner, only to weep away my bitter luck. But I dared not let go. The boss was around. I picked up the iron again, though I could hardly shift the weight back and forth. A terrible hunger rose up in me, a hunger I had been trying to forget since my lunch of 2 stale slices of bread and a scrap of cheese. Just when I had to begin saving more from eating, the starvation of days and weeks began tearing and dragging down my last strength. Let me at least have one dinner with meat before I begin to starve. For that last hour of work, I saw before my eyes meat, only meat, great big chunks of it, and I biting into the meat. Like a wolf with hunger, I ran to the cafeteria. From the end of the line, I saw the big printed bill of fare. Roast beef, 25 cents. Roast lamb, 30 cents. Beef stew, 20 cents. My eyes stopped. Over the word stew, I saw big chunks of meat, carrots, and peas with thick brown gravy. I reached for the tray and took my place on the line. I was like a mad thing straining toward the pots of food, and the line seemed to stand forever in one place.
A big, husky, fat man stood behind me. He held his tray so that the end poked into my ribs every time he shuffled on his feet. But, thank God, the line began to move up, slowly nearer the serving table. My anxious eyes leaped to the faces of the servers. I tried to see which one of them served the stew. My portion depended on her mood of the minute. If I'm lucky to strike her when she feels good, then the spoon will go deep down into the pot and come up heaping full. If she feels mean, then I get only from the tip of the spoon, a stingy portion.
God, she holds in her hands my life, my strength, new blood for my veins, new clearness in my brain to go on with the fight. Oh, if she would only give me enough to fill myself this one time.
At last I reached the serving table.
Stew, with a lot of meat in it.
Breathlessly I watched how far the spoon would go into the pot. A hot sweat broke over my face as I saw the mean hunks of potato and skinny strings of meat floating in the starched gravy which she handed me.
Please, won't you put in one real piece of meat?
And I pushed back the plate for more. I might as well have talked to the wall. She did not see me or hear me. Her eyes were smiling back to the fat man behind me who grinned knowingly at her. Stew, was all he said. She picked up my plate, pushed the spoon deep down into the pot, and brought it up heaping with thick chunks of meat.
Oh, thank you! Thank you! I'll take it now, I cried, reaching for it with both hands.
No, you don't.
And the man took the plate from the server and set it on his tray. Speechless, bewildered, I stood there, unable to move.
I asked for stew. Stew! I gave you some, and you didn't take it. She sniffed. But you didn't give me as much as you gave him. Isn't my money as good as his?
Don't you know they always give men more? Called a voice from the line.
It takes a woman to be mean to a woman, piped up another.
You're holding up the line, said the head lady, coming over with quiet politeness.
I want stew,
came again from my tight throat.
She gave you a fair portion.
But why did she give more to the man just because he was a man? I'm hungry.
All the reply I got was a cold glance.
Please move on or step out of the line.
People began to titter and stare at me. Even the girl at the serving table laughed as she put on a man's plate a big slice of fried liver, twice as big as she would have given me.
Cheaters! Robbers!
I longed to cry out to them.
Why do you have flowers on the table and cheat a starving girl from her bite of food?
But I was too trampled to speak. With tight lips, I walked out. In the street, there was no cheap restaurant in sight. I had a dreary feeling that it was the same in every other place. Since I must starve next week, I might as well begin now. I went home boiling with hate for the whole world. In my room, I found the tail end of a loaf of bread. Each bite I swallowed was wet with my tears. It was so cold that night that in every tenement people huddled into their beds early and put all their clothes over themselves to keep warm. So cold it was, even the gas froze. I stuck a candle into a bottle, took up my grammar, struggling to forget my bitterness, studying. Everything I had I wrapped around myself, and buried in my thin bedclothes, I held on to my book. My feet were lumps of ice. How could I study? But I would. I must. I forced myself to keep to my lessons like one forcing himself awake when he's falling asleep. A rap came to the door. It was repeated over and over again before I could drag myself out of my coverings to see who it was.
Mother!
I cried. Yes, there stood my mother, a shawl over her head and a big bundle on her back. She threw her arms around me and kissed me hungrily.
In a night like this, I thought you'd need a feather bed, she said, throwing her bundle on my cot.
Her face was stiff with cold, and she blew on her half-frozen fingers.
All the way from Elizabeth for you to carry it, I cried.
In the sputtering light of the candle, her sunken eyes gleamed out of their black sockets with a dumb, pleading love that made me hate myself for my selfishness. It seemed to me I never knew till now how close to my heart my mother was.
Here's a jar of herring that I pickled for you,
she said, unwrapping it from an old newspaper.
A piece of herring on bread, and you have already a good meal.
Her goodness hurt so that I began talking fast to keep back the tears in my throat. How is father? How is business? How could you get away from the store?
It's lodge night, and your father will be away till late. With all my hurrying, it took so long to get here that I'll have to go back in a few minutes to be home before he comes.
Hours she traveled, only to see me for a few minutes. God, how much bigger was mother's goodness than my burning ambition to rise in the world? Mother, you're so good to me. What can I do back for you?
I said, feeling small under her feet with unworthiness.
Only come to see me soon.
I'd do anything for you. I'd give you away my life. But I can't take time to go away out to Elizabeth. Every little minute must go to my studies.
I tore myself away from all my work to come see you.
But you are not studying for college.
Is college more important than to see your old mother?
I could see you later, but I can't go to college later. Think only of the years I wasted in the shop instead of school, and I must catch up all that lost time.
You're young yet. You have plenty of time.
It's because I'm young that my minutes are like diamonds to me. I have so much to learn before I can enter college. But won't you be proud of me when I work myself up for a school teacher in America?
I'd be happier to see you get married. What's a school teacher? Old maids, all of them. It's good enough for Goyim, but not for you.
Don't worry. I'll even get married someday. But to marry myself to a man that's a person, I must first make myself for a person.
Mother shook her head.
Ach, already I must go.
But her feet stuck to the floor, and her hands clung to me for many minutes before she could tear herself away. Long after she had gone, I felt her still in the room. As I tucked my shivering bones under the feather bed, I felt that nothing on earth was as warm as mother's love. Gone was the rankling hurt I had suffered at the cafeteria. I forgot to hate even the fat man and the head lady with her cold, low-voiced politeness. All the bitterness of my heart was forgotten. I laughed when I thought of poor dear old mother, coming so far with that big feather bed on her back. How warm I am, if only I had time to go to see her. Tomorrow I'll sit up in bed, warm for once, and study my grammar. Chapter 12. My Sisters and I. I stood in my room stirring the pot of oatmeal with one hand, and with the other I held on to my history book. I always had to read while cooking to make myself forget the dreary little meal I had to eat all by myself. I hated my stomach. It was like some clawing wild animal in me that I had to stop to feed always. I hated my eating. And yet I could hardly wait till my oatmeal was finished. I kept swallowing spoonfuls while it was still cooking. I glanced at the boiling pot. I don't have to share it with anyone. That's what made it so hateful. A longing came over me for the old kitchen in Hester Street. Even in our worst poverty, we sat around the table, together, like people. Even father's preaching and mother's worrying made mealtime something higher than mere eating and filling the stomach. How long since I ate mother's meals with the family! How far away they all seemed! How torn apart and divided! When will I have time to see them again? Before I had a chance to put the pot back on the stove, who should burst in but Fania and Bessie?
You here? Fania?
I cried as we hugged and kissed each other. Just got off the train, put in Bessie excitedly, and I brought her to you before she even saw mother. They sat down on my cot.
What a picture of poverty and riches!
Bessie, in her old fish-store clothes, a ragged kushanierka. Fania, like a queen of Sheba, shining with silks and sparkling with diamonds. Fania looked scornfully around my dingy room.
How can you bury yourself alive in such a black hole? How do you ever breathe here? A girl like you, if you'd come with me to Los Angeles, you'd live and laugh.
I'll live and laugh after I pass my college examinations.
For what does a girl need to be so educated?
You can read and write.
You know enough. But look at her, Bessie. Ain't it a shame to let herself go down like this?
Fanya picked at the patched elbow of my worn-out serge.
You're a young girl yet, Sarah. Why don't you put on a little style?
I haven't time or money for the outside show.
The outside show? What else do people see?
I glanced at my stylish sister. Was this dressed-up grand lady the same Fanya who was once loved by the poor poet Lipkin? Gone was the innocence of young dreams from her face. Good eating, good sleeping, and the sunshine of plenty breathed from her face. And she held her head high, as if she didn't come from the same family as the rest of us. But for all her shine, I could see in the shadowy places under her eyes thready lines of restlessness.
Are you at least happy with your riches?
My hand touched her shoulder as I searched her face.
Why shouldn't she be happy? Said Bessie. Look at her only, like a born Mrs. Vanderbilt. Her husband must be rolling in money, and he gives it all to her. And she has no stepchildren like me either.
Fanya did not answer. The satisfied look suddenly faded from her face, leaving her eyes hard and stony. Then her lips began to work, and she burst into bitter weeping.
Gives it all to me, she sobbed, wiping her wet face. He wants me to be dressed in the latest style, yet he kicks I'm spending all his money. He wants everything grand but cheap. When I pay $100 for a suit, I've got to tell him it's 50. To keep his mouth shut and not to have any fights, I feed him with lies. Getting money from him is like pulling teeth. These diamonds that you see on me, that's his saving bank. He buys me jewelry only to show me off to his friends that he's so rich.
She covered her face with her hands, struggling to control her unhappiness.
Where I live, I haven't a friend to talk to. All they do out there is play cards, and I play with them, only to forget myself. I can't stand it to be alone.
Why don't you read the way you used to when you were home? I asked.
I can't look at a book. My head stopped with my troubles. Ugh, how can you people know what it is to be miserable as I am?
The proud grand lady crumpled before my eyes into nothing but an East Side Yenta with a broken heart. So this is what it was to be the wife of a cloaks and suits millionaire.
But thank God you look so well.
I tried to find some bright spot to encourage her.
It's only fat you see on me, and this is just paint, she said, pointing to her cheeks.
Don't sin, warned Bessie. You're better off than me. You got a servant to do your work, so you got time even to paint your face.
Why shouldn't I have a servant? Abe can lose $500 or $1,000 playing poker in the wink of an eye, so why should I be slaving in the kitchen?
She leaped up from her chair as though to tear herself from her chains.
What eats out my heart worst of all is when I begin to look back what my life might have been with Morris Lipkin.
Father didn't bury you so deep under the ground as me, sighed Bessie. What have I from my life? Carp, flounder, pike, morning, noon, and night?
Poor Bessie, with her pitiful thin face squeezed dry of hope or happiness. Older, more life-weary than mother, she looked, in her old crushed hat and her big coarse shoes.
Let me tell you, it's terrible to be a stepmother, she wailed. At first I sewed and scrubbed and killed myself cooking for Zalman's children, but you can never do enough for them. The first dance Minnie ever went to with a young man, I bought her a grand piece of pink silk for a dress. I stayed up half the night sewing. But before it was half done, she said I didn't have any style. She had to take it to an uptown dressmaker. When she began finding fault with my work, I got so choked that I began to cry and pull up my hair. Nothing I do for these children is right for them. Then I'm better off than you married people, I exclaimed. It's not a picnic to live alone, but at least I've no boss of a husband to crush the spirit in me. But who wants to be an old maid? Cried Fanya. Some day you got to get married. Better come with me to Los Angeles. I've a wonderful young man for you out there. He and Abe are going into a partnership, and I can easy rope him in for you.
I'll tell you the truth, Fanya. The kind of a man that could be partners with Abe is not the kind that could love me, or that I could love. Besides, I don't want to get married. I've set out to do something, and I'm going to do it, even if it kills me.
It may not kill you, but if you're left an old maid, it's worse.
She seized me by the arm.
Put on your hat and coat and come with us to Mother.
If you only knew what a big bunch of lessons I've got to cram into my head in this one little day.
But this is Sunday. Even the schools are shut down today.
My work goes on Sundays and holidays. I'm like a soldier in battle. I can't stop for visiting, even with my own family.
You hard heart.
Fanya threw up her hands at me.
Come, Bessie. Let's leave her to her mad education. She's worse than Father with his holy Torah.
Chapter 13 Outcast. Noontime in the laundry. All the girls were together giggling and laughing and enjoying themselves as they ate their lunch. Only I was alone in the corner, cramming my grammar. A longing to join the crowd and be happy with them came over me, so I closed my book and moved my stool nearer to hear what the fun was all about.
"You think that was bad," Minnie Feist was saying. "Gee whiz, that was nothing. You should have seen what I seen in Coney Island on the beach."
Then a loud whisper, and with meaningful glances, she started to tell a coarse, funny story. I grew hot and cold with shame as they burst out in shouts of laughter. Instinctively, I moved my chair back to my own place. Daggers shot at me from all eyes.
"Give only a look on her, the lady. Who does she think she is?"
"Huh, that thing blows yet from herself.
Pure she is, innocent. Pfft! Leaves a father and mother for God knows why."
"I ask you only, why does a girl go to live alone?" How their words stabbed me.
"We know, kid. Can't fool us, baby."
"What's his name? And she puts on airs yet like a holy one."
Angry jabbering pelted me till the whistle for work put an end to further insults. After that, I was shut out like a greenhorn who didn't talk their language. When they gossiped bows or dances or the latest styles, their mouths snapped tight when I got near. When they planned any picnics or parties, I was left out. Hurt to the bone, I sank into a shell of stiff pride. I pretended not to see, not to hear the slights heaped on me. Lunchtime, I was always apart in my corner, my head buried in a book. But often when I seemed to be reading, I longed to throw myself at the feel of the girls and cry out to them, "Say anything you like, do anything you like. All right, hurt me, but don't leave me out. I don't want to be left out." Even in school I suffered, because I was not like the rest. I irritated the teachers, stopping the lessons with my questions. A bored weariness fell over the whole class the minute I started to speak. They'd begin to nudge each other by the sleeve and whisper, "Oh, Lord, that bug again showing off her smartness." They didn't hunger and thirst for knowledge. They weren't excited about anything they were learning, so it jarred on them that I was so excited. To them, I was only a selfish grabber of their time because I was so crazy to know too much. One evening, the teacher was reading to us the list of subjects we'd have to pass to enter college. "Who are those bosses of education who made us study so much dead stuff?" I asked. A frown of annoyance wrinkled the teacher's face. The others began to wink and smile at one another, but I couldn't help myself. My thoughts pushed themselves out of me. "I only want to know what interests me. Why should I have to choke myself with geometry? How can those tyrants over the college force all kinds of different people to stuff their heads with the same deadness that we all got to know alike? I want the knowledge that is the living life." Loud laughter fell like a chilling shower on me. Even the teacher joined in the fun. After that, they never called me by name. The minute I came, they grinned and tittered. "There goes the living life." Maybe if I could only live like others and look like others, they wouldn't pick on me so much, I thought to myself. I studied myself in the mirror. I examined, one by one, the features that gazed back at me. Tired eyes that gazed far away at nothing. a set sadness about the lips like in old maids who'd given up all hope of happiness. A gray face, a stone face, turned to stone from not living. A black shirtwaist high up to the neck, not a breath of color. Everything about me was gray, drab, dead. I was only 23, and I dressed myself like an old lady in mourning. I began talking to the gray face in the mirror. What had I done to myself to make myself look so old and ugly? Other girls as plain as I. Why do they look attractive? When they have no color, they put on color. That's what I must do. Why not? I want to be looked at, longed for, followed. I hate my goodness. The only sin on earth is to let life pass you by. The next day, I took my little penny savings, and during lunch hour I went to the nearest department store. I bought lipstick, rouge, powder, a lace collar for my waist, even red roses for my hat. Late into the night I spent fixing myself up, pinning the roses on my hat, trying on my lace collar this way and that to show off the whiteness of my throat. A wildness possessed me to make up for the pale, colorless years. I saw myself in bright red and dazzling green and gold. I could beat them all if I only let loose the love of color in me. My fingers trembled, and my eyes burned through the mirror as I began daubing on lipstick and rouge. I looked in the glass at the new self I had made. Now I was exactly like the others. Red lips, red cheeks, even red roses under the brim of my hat. Blackened lashes, darkened eyebrows, soft white lace at my neck. Ah, what a different picture. No old maid here. A young girl in the height of her bloom. But my excited happiness soon sank down. I felt funny and queer. Something was wrong, as if my painted face didn't hang together with the rest of me. On the outside, I looked like the other girls, but the easy gladness that sparkled from their eyes was not in mine. They were a bunch of light-hearted savages who looked gay because they felt gay. I was like a dolled-up dummy fixed for a part on the stage. No, no, I will be like them, I cried. I'll go like this to work. I've as much right to be gay and draw men as they. But next morning when I got into the street, I grew panicky with self-consciousness. Everybody seemed to be staring at me. I felt shamed and confused with my false face. It was as though the rouge had turned into a mask, and I could not breathe through the cover. I sneaked through the streets like a guilty thing. When I got to the laundry, I hurried into the cloakroom to tear the roses off my hat and wash the paint off my face. But before I knew what or how, the girls crowded around me.
Give a look only, the lady. Done it with a shovel. So scared she's got to scrape it off.
I turned to my work, raw with the shame that I had tried to be like the rest and couldn't. I threw myself more desperately than ever into my studies. My one hope was to get to the educated world, where only the thoughts you give out count, and not how you look. My longing for the living breath of a little understanding became centered more and more in my dream of going to college. Wherever I went, in the street, in the subway, by day and by night, I had always before my eyes a vision of myself in college, mingling every day with the inspired minds of great professors and educated higher-ups.
Chapter 14. A Man Wanted Me. At school one evening, the teacher returned my examination paper. One look and my heart stopped. I had failed in geometry. How I had forced myself to study it! But the screw for figures seemed missing in my head. A terrible doubt got me. Maybe I wasn't smart enough to swallow all that dry learning you had to swallow to enter college. Maybe I could never pass the entrance examinations. At this time of discouragement, a letter came from Fania.
Max Goldstein, the man I told you about, is coming special to New York to see you. From what I told him about you, he thinks you're just the wife he needs. I only hope you'll be lucky enough to get him. Think only. You'll have your own house and garden, your own car. You'll have servants do all your work for you.
You'll be able to wear the best stylish clothes that money can buy. You'll lift up your head and know what life is. What have you? Shutting yourself up in your black hole, not fit for a dog. You don't live, you don't eat, you don't dress like a person. And for what are you wearing out the best years of your youth? To work yourself up to be an old maid schoolteacher?
I was too impatient to read on, and threw away the letter. It was Sunday afternoon. No work and no school. It was always my best time for lessons. And now I had to begin studying all over again the geometry I hated. The books were before me on the table, the pencils, the papers, but I could not touch them. I had no heart to begin. Outside in the street it was sunshine. It was spring in the air. Other girls were enjoying themselves with their young men. The whole world was alive. Only I was shut out of life. Living people want to live, and I'm wasting myself with something so inhuman as squares and triangles. That is why I've grown dead and inhuman myself. What's all this book learning compared to a free walk in the sunshine? Maybe Fanya was right. If I keep on wearing out my years stuffing dead ashes of learning in my tired brain, later, when I'll want to live and love, it will be too late. I'll be too old. I used to say to my loneliness, if it will not kill you, it will be the making of you. All great people have to be alone to work out their greatness. But now all my high talk was hollow and unreal. The loneliness of my little room rose about me like a thick blackness, about to fall on me and crush me. The minutes passed into hours, but I still could not force myself to begin my lessons. Never before did I let time go by me so wastefully. I hated the touch of the books before me as if they were living enemies. I hated the burdens I had put upon myself to get an education. I hated book learning and colleges. All education was against life. I wanted to live and not stupefy myself with geometry. It was evening. The room was as dark as my heart. I was too tired to light the gas. I was just about to throw myself on my cot with all my things on. I wanted to forget everything and sleep my life away. Suddenly a strong hand rapped my door. "Come in," I yawned, turning on the light. A man entered. And I knew by the positive way in which he stepped into the room that this was the one my sister had sent.
"I know you better than your own sister, so much she's been telling me about you," he said by way of introduction. "I'm Max Goldstein. Shake hands."
"Oh, yes, my sister wrote me, but I did not expect you today. My room is so upset."
He swept away my confusion with his hearty laugh.
"What does the room matter? We're friends already, aren't we?"
And so it was. I liked him instantly. If only he were not looking for a wife. That made me shrink from him with self-consciousness.
"Your sister even told me how you won't doll yourself up for men," he laughed. "But I like you the way you are better than if you fixed yourself up in the grandest style.